Welcome to the Global Research Report. My name is Michel Chasadovsky, and today we have the privilege of welcoming Peter Koenig, outstanding author and economist, former staff member of the World Bank, as well as consultant to the World Health Organization, who has written extensively on the crisis which is currently affecting us, in great detail, looking at the interactions between the so-called threat of the pandemic on the one hand and the broader economic and social implications. Welcome to the program, Peter Koenig. I think ultimately the important question is, how did all this happen on the one hand? And what is going to happen in the future, particularly in view of the economic implications, the economic and social implications, but also the fact that we are moving into what might be described as the most serious debt crisis, certainly in modern history.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Michel. Let me start perhaps by saying that this does not only look like a planned destruction of the world economy, it is a planned destruction of the world economy. And there are a number of visible elements to that. For one thing, a virus, an invisible virus, which is suddenly made into a pandemic that starts almost simultaneously around the world, affecting all 193 countries of the United Nations and more of the territories all at once, is not just a coincidence. That has never happened in human history so far. So this has been clearly a planned destruction, and it's not an accident. Then at the same time, a well-prepared propaganda machine, which immediately, as soon as the pandemic is declared, or even before, started talking about the threats of this virus, planting fears in the society, fears for our lives, and fears to make sure that we all agree with the global lockdown. A lockdown which is also accompanied by social distancing, separation, social separation, prohibition of meetings. People cannot get together anymore. They can't talk with each other. Actually, people have to be afraid of each other because they could infect each other. And this is the purpose, and this is very well done by this propaganda machine. Fear actually of an invisible enemy, a virus, which is made believe is a killer virus that will attack just about everybody and kill everybody if we are not careful. It goes so far as I would say it is comparable to another fear campaign that has for the last few decades accompanied us, which is the so-called man-made CO2, which will also destroy our world. And it's as fake as the virus that will destroy humanity. But anyway, there's an agenda behind it, and I think as we advance, most people will probably think that this is a conspiracy theory, but as we advance in this game, we will realize that it is not. And I can already point to a few elements which are part of the history that will indicate that this is not just conspiracy. One of the things that is quite visible is the infamous 2010 Rockefeller report, which has described very well what is happening now. And for example, the first scenario is described in this report, which can be seen on internet, is described as the lockstep scenario, which means the whole world actually advances in lockstep according to what the elite, those who are behind this scheme, want us to do. And it works so far quite well. Then there are a number, probably this has been planned even before 2010, very likely, maybe decades before. But this is one of the first visible signs. In between, there have been many studies commissioned by WHO and also by the pharmaceuticals, which all lead to the only solution of beating this this virus is a vaccine, is a global vaccination and probably forced vaccination. That's what they would like to do. But they probably and hopefully will not reach that stage if we wake up in time. But anyway, this is the plan. And then the last event that has led into what we are living now was the so-called Event 201, which was sponsored by the Johns Hopkins University Medical School and Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, as well as the World Economic Forum, you know, which that's the forum of the elite, world elite of corporations, banks, financial institutions. Even Hollywood is presented there. Anyway, those people who meet every January in Davos and pretend to decide over the world's future, those are also behind this thing. This event took place on the 18th of October 2019 in New York City. And one of the main features of the event was a computer simulation of exactly a pandemic. They call it a coronavirus pandemic that would kill within 18 months, would kill about 65 million people and would destroy the economy, actually wipe out more than 30% of the stock market, cause untold unemployment and bankruptcies, and literally destroy the world economy as we are starting to experience is happening right now. All of that was predicted by this event 201. It can also be seen on internet. There are videos available on internet about the event, and it makes clear that this is not a conspiracy of this interview. It is a conspiracy that has been planned for humankind for a long time in advance. Of course, in order to reach a global government, which is actually also planned for a long time, I think already in the late 90s or mid 90s, world leaders, the Clintons and so on, have talked about a one world government or a new world government, whatever you want, but it's a one world government which would follow strict rules on one currency, probably the dollar, on a uniform culture, uniform languages, and so on, which would control the world population. Another element of this is, and this has been propagated also for a long time by the Rockefellers and the Bill Gates people and people related to him, is the reduction of the world population, a massive reduction of the world population. So all of this has begun now with 2020, which we will also see as the so-called, we can also call it the Agenda 2021, which will then merge with the Agenda 2030, which is camouflaged by the 2030 Sustainable Development Goals of the United Nations. But behind all of this is actually the execution of this plan, of which we have just seen the beginning. Now,
if I could just intervene one moment. Sure. We've reached, in a sense, we've reached a turning point. As you pointed out, there's a history behind this. And then there were decisions that were taken at the World Economic Forum in December. And then if we look at the timeline, then in February, we had the stock market crashes. And then, starting in March, we had the so-called lockdown of the real economy. Now, I think one issue which has to be addressed, first of all, the stock market crash is part of this process. It's not something separate. But secondly, the lockdown, which essentially means the closure of the real economy, and the fact that people are confined to their homes. In some cases, they don't have homes, so they're confined. Now, the social, economic, and health impacts of that lockdown are dramatic, because immediately millions of people are losing their jobs. The health impacts in some countries, there's famine. There's an impoverishment of certain sectors of the population. And as you pointed out, this is unprecedented in world history. Now, the economists, and I think that, the conventional economists have a tendency to say we had 1929 was the crash, then we had 2008, and that this crash is the third one, the third big crash, and it's not comparable to the other two. Well, the other two were based on entirely different mechanisms, speculative trade and so on. But now we have a decision-making process of so-called global governance, which ultimately instructs the governments in all these countries to close down their economy. And then they make us believe that this is something which will lead to resolving the pandemic. But we're left with a situation of bankrupt economies, small and medium-sized enterprises which have been liquidated, airlines have gone into bankruptcy, the tourist industry, and so on. Now, what is the rationale? How can we justify this as economists? You and I, we're economists. How can we justify this in economic terms and say, well, we have to come to the rescue of the population who are being affected by this virus, when in fact we see that many of the virologists and immunologists and so on, medical doctors, who authorities say, well, no, it's not what it's made out to be. It's linked up to the SARS-1, which was a pneumonia, seasonal flu type of infection. And what justifies closing down the global economy to come to the rescue of people affected by pneumonia and seasonal influenza?
Yes, well, you're absolutely right. I mean, there's no justification whatsoever. And as a matter of fact, there was a recent study commissioned by the Interior Ministry of Germany, which commissioned about 10 of the most important or most visible and most renowned medical doctors, virologists, and biologists of German universities and so on. And they compiled a report which they labeled, and that was not supposed to be known by the public, they labeled the report a false alarm, literally a false alarm. Now, this report comprises about 92 or 93 pages and goes into all details, which I don't want to mention now. But the bottom line of this is that this report was leaked to the media. It was internal to the Ministry of Interior, and it was leaked to the media. And of course, the media immediately picked it up. And once it was out, the doctors, they said, okay, now it is out, we will organize a press conference and talk about it. Now, what came out of this press conference in brief is that it is more than just a false alarm, that this false alarm is actually may cause much more deaths than the virus does in Germany and probably worldwide. But they talk particularly in Germany, they say up to 125,000 people may die because they were not attended by hospitals. Hospitals, as you probably know, were reserved not only in Germany, in most of Europe and the United States, for COVID patients, so most of them were empty or half empty, and cancer patients, heart patients were not attended, and they have already died or may die because they will not get the medical attention they otherwise would have. Then there is the whole economy, which is collapsing not only in Germany, it's all over in Europe, it's in the United States, it's in the entire world. And what does this economy cause? A lot of unhappiness, unwariness, insecurity, anxieties, and of course, all of that lowers your defense system. So people who are actually suffering under these anxieties and under the constant fear of the virus will be much more vulnerable to get sick, either by the virus or otherwise. And we have already, the Lancet has recently issued some indications that the suicide rate is on the rise. They have done that the last time in Greece, and since then not reported anymore the exact figures, because of course it's not very popular. But this is an effect. And another effect is that in many countries, especially developing countries of the so-called global south, people will probably die more from famine because the lockdown takes away their employment. And we have to recognize, contrary to the West and the global North, where labor is more or less organized, in the global South, 60 or 70% in some countries of people are virtually informal workers. So they have no employment contracts, they're nowhere registered. They go from day to day or from week to week or sometimes from months to months to earn their living. And now with a total lockdown, they have nothing. They have not even enough money to pay their rent and to nurture their family. So they have to get out, they have to do something. And if they can't, they will die from famine. And that has happened already. I mean, there are reports about that. And in fact, the World Food Organization has already said, I mean, per year, as of now, as of the end of 2019, on average, about 9 million people die by famine throughout the world. This figure will increase, according to the World Food Organization, to 150 million, possibly to 200 million of people who will be vulnerable for dying from famine. Doesn't mean that they necessarily die from famine, but they will be highly vulnerable, and many of them will actually die from famine. And this is enormous. This is an absolute disaster. And other people will be, of course, they're in the informal sector, so they have no social safety nets, they have no health insurance, they have no access to medical doctors, since everything has been privatized anyway by institutions like the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund over the past decades, even health services, education, and any kind of social services. So they're totally on their own. They have no help whatsoever, or very, very sparse help. And these people, they are actually going to be, this is the bulk of the disaster. For example, you know, just an example, at present, the ILO, the International Labour Office, 6 months into COVID, they say almost 500 million people worldwide are already unemployed or underemployed. They predict that by the end of this year or in the middle of next year, up to 2 billion people, or 58% of the world's total labor force, might be unemployed or underemployed. This is enormous. Can you imagine what that means? They have nothing to eat, and what will happen to them? And out of that, already today, almost 270 million people, young people aged 15 to 24, are not employed or underemployed. They have no education, no training, and they will endure even worse conditions in their future if they reach a future. So this despair is unbelievable. And I think what we have so far, we haven't even seen really the tip of the iceberg, of this huge iceberg which is still expecting us. bankruptcies, for example, as you pointed out, Michel, at the beginning, you know, the stock market is intimately linked to all of this. Of course, this was planned very, very carefully. But of course, we haven't seen yet the total disaster of bankruptcies that will probably come in the second half, and the second half of this year and the first half of next year, which will be another domino on unemployment and on more misery. So it is an absolute disaster of worldwide dimensions that we have never seen, far, far outranking whatever happened in 1929.
Just a question, yes. Because essentially what you describe are the consequences and the process of global impoverishment. But that process of global impoverishment is well beyond poverty. It's poverty and despair. It's a process of exclusion. But then the question is, at the same time, in the last few months, we have witnessed the enrichment of a very small segment of the population. In other words, the billionaires. Now, the question is, what is ultimately, because this is really a war of financial capitalism against what I would describe as real capitalism, okay? In other words, you're sitting in an office in Wall Street and wherever with your foundations and so on. There is a decision-making process through intergovernmental organizations, governments. You have to control these governments in a sense. They have to be corrupt. They have to serve those interests. But ultimately, there is an intent, which is to install a global economy which is controlled by a handful of financial institutions, where these financial institutions will ultimately emerge in the wake of the, well, maybe alongside the pandemic, in a sense picking up the pieces, taking control of bankrupt enterprises, airlines, and most probably at a very low price. So there's an economic, I mean, this is an economic intent. In other words, in Latin America, all the airlines are bankrupt. Well, who's going to take them over? So in other words, this project is one which is conducive to appropriation of real assets by a handful of financial institutions, wealthy individuals, foundations. And it is, as you pointed out, it is distinct from anything else that we have lived in the course of history, because it is based on instructions which are handed from some central authority, which is unnamed. The World Economic Forum is behind it, the Gates Foundation and so on, rich individuals and so on. But it's a whole very complex network, and it has a rationale. It's to take control over that real economy, deny countries their sovereignty. And now the next phase, and I'd like to get into a discussion of the next phase, which is the global debt. It's the fact that countries around the world, for the moment, they're handing out money. I know that in Canada, the size of the public debt is going to double overnight. We know that. It's probably even an underestimate. And then what happens? Then it's austerity measures, right? Right. Now, everybody's saying, oh, the governments are being generous, but next year it's going to be the most devastating austerity measures, leading to the privatization of everything that you can privatize, privatization of the state, the cities, and so on. So yes. Maybe describe, and I think, as you pointed out, that there's a situation as far as the developing countries are concerned, and then there's one which, with regard to the developed. And I recall that back, I think it was a couple of months ago, when a major rescue package was put together by Goldman Sachs in favor of Italy, okay? And then a few days later, they said, well, Italy has junk bond status. Well, in fact, in Canada, we're intimating to junk bond status as well, okay? That in fact, the whole state apparatus as we know it today is in fact defunct.
Yes. Well, yes, I call this the foreign debt machine. And if you, and as you already started talking about and pointed out, the debt is dealt with differently in the global north by developed countries, industrialized countries, than it is in developing countries. Although it's basically, most of this debt is national debt. Obviously not all of it, but most of the debt is national debt. And I mean, what the United States does, all the rescue packages of their corporations, and particularly the financial sector, Canada, also in Switzerland particularly, this is all local debt. You know, it's produced, it's monetization of local debt, but it stays local mostly in the global north. However, in the global south, this local debt, which is also can be managed locally, is monetized into foreign debt, and mostly dollar denominated foreign debt. By whom? Okay, now comes the villains, the same ones that we know, that's the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank and all the associated international or regional development banks supported by Wall Street. There you go, and now to, for example, the IMF. The IMF has created a fund, probably it's already higher, of $1 trillion just for rescue packages. And a few weeks ago, they had already about 60 candidates, 60 applicants. By now, it must be much, much larger than the number of applicants of countries who want some of these rescue packages from the IMF. Most of this money from the IMF is not necessary because their debt is in local money. They can generate with their sovereign, they can actually make their central banks, sovereign central banks, which then produce the necessary amount of money that they can manage internally of repaying as they want. They can levy interest or no interest on this debt, on this local debt, whatever they want. They're sovereign countries. However, sovereignty has already been killed by propaganda and by actions of these institutions over the past decades. So it has become very normal that the IMF and the World Bank come with rescue packages, and all the associated organizations with rescue packages to these countries to actually monetize their local debt into dollars. And this is actually what is happening. And this has actually nothing to do anymore with real economics, because we don't do it in the north, or hardly ever. And for example, the example of Italy that you mentioned, you know, Italy protested. They didn't need money from Goldman Sachs or from the World Bank or from IMF. They can actually step out of the euro and become their own sovereign country again with a sovereign national bank and deal with their local debt locally. And that's what they have threatened to do. I don't know whether they eventually will. There's a lot of pressure behind the European Union, behind especially the European Union members, which are part of the Eurozone, that they do not step out. But each one of these countries, including Greece, that went through that, could have stepped out of the European Union, especially of the Eurozone, and return to their own local currency. And most of the countries in developing, in the global south, developing countries, they could really gradually abandon their relation to foreign currencies, mostly the dollar, and especially in South America, and become their sovereign countries again by creating their local currencies to rescue their local economy, rather than going to the IMF and say, well, we need your money and we dollarize our national debt. This is what happened.
An observation. The question really, and I think we have to conclude the program, will be on the following week with more analysis and understanding of what's going on. But I think you have put forth some important solutions to this, to the so-called debt crisis. In other words, that we have to erase the debt. But the problem that we are now facing the problem we're facing is that the governments, what we call in French la classe politique, they are co-opted. And yes, they are co-opted by the creditors of the state. In other words, billions and billions of dollars of debt, as you said, in the global south, they will be simply squashed by the international financial institutions and the regional development banks, and they will have to obey orders. In other words, the whole issue of sovereignty will be, of course, squashed as well. But I'm not so sure in the European Union, particularly, let's say, countries like Italy, which have had sort of historical links to Goldman Sachs for so long, okay? I think that your proposal ultimately, which is to say we might reach a point where we should say cancel all debts. But to do that, we need a political apparatus as well as a movement, a grassroots movement, which will challenge the lies which you have exposed in your presentation and say, and these are criminal lies, okay? When they say, well, we have to close down the economy to save lives, okay? Close down the economy so that people don't get the virus. That is a lie. And the scientists have proven that it is a lie.
Absolutely.
So yeah. Again, the solutions to this crisis that you've raised, which are extremely important, the issue of, the issue of public banking, but more so the issue of democracy and how, in fact, this model is really creating a police state apparatus. You know, you can't protest against these the global governance, because global governance is imposing social distancing they're even imposing the fact that you can't go to a museum or to a concert or to a football match. So that concluding notes. We are in a situation, as far as independent media, of challenging millions of lies which come out in the mainstream media. Fortunately, we have economic analysts and authors like Peter Koenig that say the truth. And we have medical doctors that say the truth. But what we are witnessing is a process. And I think you brought it out very clearly when you talked about CO2, where the lie becomes the truth, that the consensus is a big lie, where we are led to believe that this epidemic is going to kill the planet, and the only way to save our lives is to close down the economy, close down our institutions, and so on. It's a lie. It's a lie. And we will proceed with this debate on global research. Particular thanks to Peter Koenig, who has been with us today. I give you, maybe you want to conclude what next, and then so that we conclude this program.
Okay, well, I think we should try to do is to bring at least the economic truth into the population. What can be done in order to stem this trend of enslavement by debt? And there are solutions, and some of the solutions we have already mentioned before, is deal with national debt nationally, with local banks, with the public banks, not with the international banking system, not with the dollarized debt, and so on. And this is all possible. It may not be possible from one day to another to de-dollarize, but it is certainly possible to have to develop policies to do so. And I think if we are talking about the European Union, that there are 29 or 19 of the 28 or 27 now countries are within the Eurozone, shows that these countries are actually tied together by a currency which is not their currency. Their currency, the euro, has nothing to do with most countries' economy because it's an imposed currency in two countries which do not even have a common constitution, common goals. So this is an unsustainable union. And that's why I think countries like Italy may be close of saying we are stepping out of the Eurozone. There has been new talks lately in Greece about precisely that, because one of the solutions would be, okay, we forgive all the debt, the debt jubilee, which has been existing for 10,000 of years. The Babylonians have known that. And it would be possible to do that in our capitalist system too, to start from scratch and give everybody a new chance. But of course, that doesn't happen with neoliberalism. But it would be a possibility. But aside from that possibility, I think what countries can do and maybe should consider doing is regaining their sovereignty, their national sovereignty, and start again with their local economy for local production, with local public banks, with the nationalized and sovereign central bank that can dish out money for the local economy as it is needed, and they can deal with that debt locally, internally, and do not need international organizations. That's basically 101 of economics. And when we have gotten so far away from that with globalization, which imposed globalization, that we somehow have to make sure that people and countries understand and people understand that this is not the solution, that they can go back, they can request their governments to go back to local economies and build up national sovereignty again, financial sovereignty, political sovereignty, and internal democracy.
Thank you, Peter, for this this analysis and understanding. I recall to our readers that Peter Koenig's articles are published on globalresearch.ca. In fact, they're published in several languages on our French site, mondialisation.ca, and on our Spanish site, which is based in Mexico City, which is called globalisation.ca. Our thanks to Peter Koenig in this Global Research Report coming from Montreal and from Alaman, Switzerland, with Peter Koenig. Thank you very much.